Greetings, friends. Welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the film review podcast, where we have taste. We have a sense of taste as well. My name is Whitney Seibold. I am a film critic of no renown whatsoever, and with me as always is...
My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs. I never pretended to have any renown. And this week on Critically Acclaimed, we're reviewing the new releases Moonfall, The Worst Person in the World, Polystyrene, I Am a Cliché, Alone with You, and Slapface.
Yeah, it sounded like you were calling polystyrene the worst person in the world.
Well, a lot of things sound like a lot of things. I'm not responsible for that.
Why don't you talk about Moonfall?
We're just going to jump right in, huh?
Because I'm eager to hear about it, and I'm sad I missed it.
Okay.
This is only playing in theaters, and so I wasn't able to catch it in my very few spare hours that I have these days.
Moonfall is the latest film from Roland Emmerich. Roland Emmerich is one of the more significant filmmakers of the turn of the century. He started making sort of smaller genre films, I think, in the 80s and 90s. I saw this one weird ghost movie he did about a couple of, like...
Yeah, Ghost Chase.
Ghost Chase, yeah. A couple of losers trying to, like, make their way in wacky Hollywood, and they befriend a ghost, and they decide to chase that ghost. I remember very little of that weird film.
What I remember most about Ghost Chase is the pop song that they used incessantly throughout it.
Oh.
It was called Imagination by, I don't even know how to pronounce it, Balooey Sum.
Okay.
Balooey Sumé. Balooey Sumé. I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce the actual artist's name. Imagination will make a man of you. They played that song over and over again. Yeah, Roland Emmerich, interesting fellow. Because his films are always incredibly ambitious.
Yeah.
They're clunky and soap operatic.
Mm-hmm.
They typically have pretty shallow characterization. They go for a lot of broad character types.
But they connect, and they connect mostly. Some of them don't work, but they connect for, I think, two reasons. One, he has a great eye. He is, in terms of just pure cinema spectacle.
Or just for visuals, yeah.
Just for visuals. He's a great visual storyteller. He did a film...
For the most part.
No, no, no. I will stand by this, actually. Right. I'm not saying he tells profound stories.
Mm.
But I think if you turn off the sound in a Roland Emmerich movie, you can tell what the fuck is going on.
Yeah.
He did a film a couple of years ago, I think it's the most recent film besides Moonfall, called Midway. Kind of came and went, you know, it was number one at the box office for like a week, and then it was gone. And it's a World War II story about the Battle of Midway, one of the most significant military conflicts of the 20th century. The acting is terrible. The spectacle is amazing. And in fact, I've argued that if you just turn off the sound of that movie and you put like 20 dialogue cards in there just for exposition purposes, you've got a dynamite silent film. Like a truly great silent film. He could do it. He knew how to tell a story that way. But the other thing that he did, and after like four or five films, he hooked up with a screenwriter named Dean Devlin, and together...
Made some of the biggest hits of the 90s.
They made Universal Soldier, which was a modest success, but it was a big hit. It was Jean-Claude Van Damme and Dolph Lundgren were Vietnam soldiers who died, but they were collected. Their bodies were collected after the war, and they were turned into unstoppable zombie killing machines by the government. And then Jean-Claude Van Damme starts remembering his past, and so does Dolph Lundgren, but Dolph Lundgren was, like, worse than, like, Marlon Brando in Apocalypse Now. Like, he was like a serial killer in the jungle.
Sweet.
And Jean-Claude Van Damme has to stop Dolph Lundgren and his army of Universal Soldiers. That movie is a hoot. But from that point on, they found a formula. And this formula worked. And it kind of still works. And the formula is really, really simple. You know that one silly conspiracy theory you've heard? It's real. That's it. Almost all of their movies, almost all of their big movies are that. Stargate, what if aliens built the pyramids? That's the movie. There's always like one character at the beginning who gives a speech about why they're right. Nobody believes them, but it turns out they're right. So the government goes to them and they have to like save the day. Bada bing. Independence Day plays out a little bit like that. Jeff Goldblum is the guy who figures out the aliens are going to attack before everyone else, but also it turns out Area 51 is real. Slight change in the formula, but bada bing, you got it. Day After Tomorrow, turns out climate change is super duper real.
And it's like, so, it's dangerous like a movie villain.
Like we didn't realize how real it was. Like, it was going to, like, all hit tomorrow. Like, so, boom. It kind of treats it like a conspiracy theory, but bada bing. Anonymous? Anonymous is, what if Shakespeare didn't write his own plays? With all the bombast you'd get from The Day After Tomorrow. 2012? What if the
Aztec calendar was right?
What if the Aztec calendar was right and said that in 2012 the world would end? What if that was real? Who the hell knows? Holy shit.
I'm kind of surprised he hasn't done, like, a Nostradamus biopic.
I would not be surprised if that's in the cards. Even White House Down is basically like, hey, what if Republicans really are all out to get us and want to continue the war machine forever? And if we could just put a stop to the Republicans... we'd all live in a utopia. At the end of that movie, after the Republicans have been defeated, they literally declare world peace.
World peace.
Amazing.
That's the cherry on the top of the...
It's amazing.
White House Down is one of the best action films of the last decade.
Yes, it is.
It is excellent.
Truly glorious.
And, of course, Stonewall. What if Stonewall was started by Warhorse?
I'm not saying every single film he's ever made fits this mold.
No.
But most of them do, and most of the hit ones do.
Yeah.
And Moonfall is a return to that formula. Except here, the theory is something I've never fucking heard before. And if this is a real theory, it's... I don't want the lesson. I'm not asking for the emails.
I just
don't know about it, and it just comes across as really silly.
I do want to know about it, because I'm a big fan of conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
The fun ones.
Yeah.
Stuff like QAnon, where it's like, oh, it turns out fascists are good. I don't want to hear about those ones.
Yeah,
those are less fun.
Those are the conspiracy theories that take up the most bandwidth today are diabolical.
Yeah.
Because they're not fun. They're not about, what if the universe is more magical than we thought? It's always about how, it's always clearly not real. Like, there's definite evidence right now. It's all stuff that happened recently that we can definitely prove.
The idea is, like, what if being gentle and progressive is actually, that's the real conspiracy.
What if that's the most evil thing in the world?
The reason people are acting, like, gentle and progressive is because they're in the thrall of some sort of, like, pizza-based sex slavery ring.
It's just creepy and manipulative, and it's all very politically based. And that's not to say that there isn't a political bias behind a lot of the conspiracy theories I already just talked about, and some of which weren't even conspiracy theories. Climate change is a real thing, but the movie treats it like a conspiracy theory, is my point. With
the cover-up is the
cover-up is a conspiracy theory. It's a good point. In any case, this one is just so ridiculous. It's like the flat earth theory, but sillier. Which is impressive, because there's not a lot sillier than the flat earth theory.
Is the moon made of green cheese? Are Wallace and Gromit up there chasing around a vending machine?
That would be less silly than what we got. So, I remember when the trailers for Moonfall came out, and a lot of people were really excited about it, because this looked really, really stupid. But then I started putting out trailers that made it look like aliens might be involved, and everyone's like, whoa, 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 spoilers! Literally the first scene in the movie. It's not a spoiler, it's literally the plot of the film. They're not even hiding this. The conspiracy is, what if the moon is a cover-up?
The moon?
The moon.
Like, the moon was...
The moon is a lie.
Constructed.
Yes.
Okay.
The moon...
What is
the moon? A megastructure. That's the term they use all the time. One of the protagonists he refers to... This is played by John Bradley from Game of Thrones. He refers to himself, not as a scientist... but a megastructuralist. He only studies megastructures, which is basically like Dyson spheres, but there are other kinds.
Okay.
The idea is...
Dyson spheres is a constructed planet with a miniature sun on the inside of a gigantic shell.
Uh-huh.
And
that uses the sun to power the planet.
And the people who live near this sun live on the inside of this shell.
Yeah. It's a sci-fi concept. It's nothing. No one's actually working on this.
No. This is not something that's been built.
It's a pretty ridiculous idea if you think about it.
And I have to look up who Dyson is, in fact.
Yeah, it's named after the guy from T2. Anyway, so the idea is the moon is a megastructure. The moon was created by aliens. We don't know why. I'm not going to tell you exactly why. Suffice it to say, it is stupid. And at the beginning of the movie, Patrick Wilson and Halle Berry are in space. and they are attacked by an alien thingy. It looks like it looks kind of like the smoke monster from Lost, like a big kind of tendril made of like nanobots.
Okay.
And they attacks them. And they like crash on Earth and everything's fine, but you know one of their guys dies. And then the alien thing burrows into the moon, and then like 12 years later, the moon is fucked. The moon has decided to kill us all. The moon is, it's the orbit of the moon is starting to degrade.
Okay.
And in a spiraling.
That can be enough. It can just be a disaster.
Oh,
right?
That would have been enough right there. That's that's enough right there.
Yeah.
The moon is starting to degrade. I don't even need a reason for that. That's just a problem that needs to be solved. It's kind of like in the core. Oh no, the core of the Earth is starting to slow down. They have to come up with some bullshit reason for that. Just say it is. I don't care why. That's not why we're here. But in any case, the moon has started to degrade. It's going to destroy the Earth. The moon's going to get closer and closer and closer to the Earth. It's going to create gravity wells that cause people to fall upwards towards the moon. It's going to siphon off our oxygen. There's scenes in the movie, and this might be my favorite thing, where people have to outrun the moon on foot. The moon snuck up on them.
No, God.
They're like, look, God, the moon! And they have to run! Except for the moon gets them.
Oh, my God. I can only think of the scene in The Day After Tomorrow where they outrun cold.
It's like Roland Emmerich was tired of hearing shit about that, so he decided to come up with something sillier. So it's now people outrunning the moon. Because the moon is getting closer every revolution.
Here it comes.
As it gets bigger and bigger and starts like lifting people off the ground. Every single time. Wonderfully stupid. Almost every single line of dialogue in this movie is either just generic or really ridiculous. The line that got the biggest laugh in the theater, I actually can't tell you because it's a spoiler. It's on the very last scene, but it was a laugh riot. The second biggest laugh was after the moon has started to degrade. Everyone knows that you can see it getting closer in the sky. All of Los Angeles is flooded. You know, there pieces of the planet are getting ripped upwards. Earthquakes are starting to shatter everything. And Halle Berry goes to Patrick Wilson. Patrick Wilson is a former astronaut, and they need to sneak up on the moon because the moon can recognize their technology. So we got to use an old space shuttle, Wilson can fly the old space
shuttle. The moon recognizes us.
Yes, yes, 100% yes. And so you go to Patrick Wilson, and they say, Patrick Wilson, my friend. They say, Patrick Wilson, we need you to jump in a space shuttle and save the Earth from the moon. And Patrick Wilson says, and this is a quote, I don't know, I got a lot of stuff going on down here.
More important.
Yeah,
more important than
I'm a little busy right now. Anyway, Patrick Wilson and Halle Berry.
Do go on, please.
Yeah, Patrick Wilson, Halle Berry, and John Bradley have to jump in a space shuttle. They have to take off in the space shuttle as a giant tidal wave hits it, which is amazingly epic.
It's a splash like, through the tidal wave.
Pretty fucking amazing, actually, I'm not going to lie. And they got to fly up to the moon. And that's when shit gets weird.
Starting then
is when it gets weird. Because once they actually get, like, in the moon, we've learned more shit. And I'm not going to ruin that for you. I want people to see this movie.
Is it the creatures from The Explorers?
No. I wish that would have been a great callback. It's a different vibe.
Right.
It's a very different vibe. They're going
for
something
totally
different.
Don't tell me, because I'm going
to
see this.
You need to see this.
There's no way I'm not seeing this.
This movie is... I'm trying to think of some of the other stupid lines. I've lost track of how many lines of dialogue or something like, you don't understand. We're dealing with a megastructure. Everything you know has just been thrown out the window. Basically just as an excuse to have no science whatsoever in this thing. Also, and I don't know if Elon Musk is a friend of the screenwriter, or if he like gave them money or like helped them like use like a space shuttle that he owned or whatever. On two separate occasions, he is randomly celebrated. There's a part early in the movie where...
Boy, howdy, do I love that Elon Musk fellow.
Yes. You joke.
Oh,
but
no.
Yes.
Oh, no.
Early on in the movie, John Bradley knows that the moon is going to destroy us all, and he's trying to figure out how to save the world. And apropos of nothing, he's just in his room, like, God, there must be something I can do. What would Elon do? That's it. That's the whole bit.
But are you sure it's Musk?
Yes.
Maybe it's somebody else named Elon.
He has a poster. He has a poster of Elon Musk behind him, and that's it.
That's not necessarily conclusive.
Later in the movie, they name check SpaceX real fast, at which point John Bradley turns to everyone and says, I love Elon.
Oh, no.
As though they're bros. They went to college together on first name basis.
Maybe he was talking about Sissy SpaceX. The actress.
Okay, so we're going to go up into outer space, and we're going to need to refuel the space shuttle on Sissy SpaceX.
Yes.
She's just flying around.
She's up there. She's a rich movie star. Maybe she moved up to a satellite.
Sure.
And she runs it and knows a lot about astrophysics. I don't know about everything about Sissy SpaceX's personal life.
You know what? I'm not going to lie. I don't know everything about Sissy SpaceX's personal life either.
She's not like a close personal friend of mine.
No. You've put me in my place, sir. You have put me in my place. Okay. I, too, have to concede that Sissy SpaceX might also be an orbiting space station when she's not making movies and television.
You know, she evolved.
Oh, yes.
She turned into a machine, and now she's a spacefaring being.
Of course. My apologies. I'm the jerk. This is an incredibly silly film.
Yeah, I can tell.
At no point does the movie really pretend that it's not. Mm. And that's why I don't mind how silly it is. If you're not apologizing, if you're not trying to pretend that you're smart, I don't care if you're trying to entertain me with silliness, you go for it. Like, I love Geostorm. Geostorm is a wonderfully entertaining...
Which is a Dean Devlin movie.
Dean Devlin wrote and directed that one, and I gotta tell you, that movie is a hoot. I think my favorite part of that particular film... You've seen Geostorm, right?
Oh, yes.
You understand the glory... That is Geostorm.
Prepare for glory, yes. Leonidas himself.
You know when you're watching a movie and there's like, the movie never says something is going on, but in your head, you've got like another movie that's going concurrently?
Okay.
Yeah. The best way to watch Geostorm is if you imagine, and they never mention this out loud in the movie, but nothing in the movie contradicts it. You imagine that Abby Cornish... Her character, she's a Secret Service agent who's in love with Jim Sturgis. If you imagine that Abby Cornish's character is a Terminator who is just learning how to love, makes the movie a lot. It makes everything about her character make a lot more sense, and the movie is 1,000 times better.
She's like weirdly cold in
that
movie.
She's weirdly cold. I love her. I don't know what direction Dean Devlin gave her. She's a great actor. I have no idea what direction Dean Devlin gave her in that movie. But she's playing it like a Terminator who is just now, thanks to Jim Sturgis, starting to learn what love means. I love that. Moonfall is a profoundly stupid film. I've heard people argue that they wish it was stupider. That they wish it was even more ridiculous. But I think the reason why it's in this like weird space... between unbelievably ridiculous to a wonderfully entertaining degree and surprisingly straightforward is because I'm not convinced anyone in this production, anyone whatsoever, knew that this was silly.
They're just playing it completely straight.
They just thought this was neat.
Well, if you play it like a comedy, it falls apart.
Yeah, you can't... I mean, there's a way...
A silly film only reads as silly if it's completely earnest.
I'm not saying this couldn't be done. I'm not saying that, like, if Edgar Wright wanted to make a disaster movie, he couldn't find some way to play with it the way he played with the zombie genre or the cop genre.
Yeah.
Maybe it could work and still be what it is and be a satire, too. Roland Emmerich is not a self-aware filmmaker. He's not poking fun at himself. He takes every story he's telling. He's funny. He has a sense of humor. He knows when things are over the top. But he's never really making fun of what he's doing. I think the only time he kind of did was in Godzilla. I think it's one of the reasons why Godzilla didn't connect with anybody. Because it felt like it was kind of making fun of Godzilla. It was like not taking Godzilla seriously. Everything else he's done, he's taking it really, really seriously, even if it's over the top. And this is one of those things. So because he's taking it seriously, you're going to get a lot of scenes in the movie which are played straight. There's not a laugh in there, not even an ironic laugh. Mm. But for me, that makes the silly stuff better. For me, that just makes it all the more absurd when, again, the moon sneaks up on you. like Jason Voorhees in the woods. That makes it so much more glorious to me. When there's a scene in this movie
Knock, knock, who's that at the door? Wait a minute, don't answer it. It could be the moon.
Halle Berry is working at NASA in this movie, and she's got a boss, and the boss is like, okay, I know what we'll do. We'll send people up to the moon to investigate what's up with all this moon stuff, and that goes horribly wrong. And Halle Berry says something like, oh, this is everything we were worried AI would do. And then it's like, what the hell are you talking about? And then the guy's just like, yeah, I don't know what the hell's going on anymore. I quit NASA. I'm out. You're in charge of NASA now. Do what thou wilt. And Halle Berry's like, what should I do? And the guy's like, I don't know, investigate our conspiracy theory files? So she goes to this conspiracy building and like goes inside and looks inside all the conspiracy boxes, and who shows up but Donald Sutherland for one scene of completely deadly serious, like he's the same character he played in JFK, deadly serious monologue about how the moon is a cover-up. No one told him this was a joke. He's playing it for real. Bless Donald Sutherland.
He's a professional.
He's a professional actor. He does his fucking job. But he's not treating it like a joke. No one's really treating it like a joke unless a joke is being made. And that's why the laugh-out-loud lines are unbelievably hilarious. That's why the action sequences are very impressively filmed. There's a couple of, like, wonky effects in here. Mm-hmm. Like, the tidal wave taking out Los Angeles doesn't look great. But, like, mostly it looks quite good. But, like, it makes all that stuff just more worth it to me. So, this is not Roland Emmerich's greatest work. I would argue that his greatest work is White House Down.
Yeah.
I would argue that slightly beneath that, and I may be alone on this, because I know Universal Soldier is plays like gangbusters, great film. Stargate is a lot of fun, it's got problems, but, you know, it's kind of neat. Independence Day was a blockbuster for a reason, it's insipid, but it works. For me, his truly other masterpiece is The Day After Tomorrow.
Okay.
It is so on the nose in every single fucking way, and we laughed at it at the time. Like, oh yeah, oh, you know, with climate change is real, but this is ridiculous. And now we're like looking at like half the planet is on fire, and Day After Tomorrow doesn't even look that weird anymore.
Yeah,
I feel like we actually owe him an apology for that. So this is nowhere near the top two for me. All
right.
But this is fun Roland Emmerich. I hope people see this. It's the kind of movie when you're going to see it at home, you're going to say to yourself, oh, this would have been fun in a theater. And it would have. If, on the other hand, you choose not to, either because of the pandemic or just because of money or whatever, you're still going to enjoy it at home. Make sure you see this at some point. This movie is a very stupid hoot.
I love stupid hoots.
I had a good time watching this very stupid movie. It's harmless, except for the Elon Musk thing, which I don't understand. It's very, very fun. I had a good time. I can't wait for you to watch it.
Do you suppose Roland Emmerich is like he's a tech bro? Like he's trying to get into like blockchain shit.
Maybe.
NFTs or whatever.
I mean, he's working on like the cutting edge of like, you know, he's been working on the cutting edge of like cinematic visual effects for so long. You might have like just some interest in that kind of thing. I don't know. Honestly, I actually don't know how much he actually believes in these conspiracy theories. I'm guessing after all the interviews he's done, he probably believes that Shakespeare didn't write Shakespeare's plays. A lot of people don't believe that. I don't get it, but it's a popular conspiracy theory.
It's not Francis Bacon. Who was it in Anonymous?
Oh, it's Earl of De Vere. It was De Vere.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Hold on. I think I remember the guy's name. Something De Vere.
No, some Earl did it. Who's usually not even one of the first.
It was the Earl of Oxford.
Oh, it was Oxfordian. Okay.
It was an Oxfordian film.
That's the conspiracy theorists. They call themselves Oxfordians.
That particular school of thought believed that
the Earl of Oxford. There's also people who believe that Christopher Marlowe wrote them or that Francis Bacon wrote them, et cetera, et cetera.
Those tend to be the big three.
I'm of the opinion that Shakespeare. Wrote the plays attributed to Shakespeare.
Yeah.
I think that...
I've never seen any meaningful evidence of the contrary other than a general disbelief that a poor person couldn't have done it.
Yeah, I do... Because he works with such, like, big productions, it's entirely possible that he is maybe not to, like, a Randian degree, but somebody who is okay with the idea of wealth. Like, he doesn't see the wealthy as villains. Mm. Wealthy people typically aren't depicted as villains in his movies.
Yeah.
Politicians
are. Conservative politicians usually are. Warmongers often are.
Yeah, I know he's, like, way off to the left if White House Down wasn't a pretty clear indicator of that. He's,
right.
Also a gay man, so he's active in like gay charities and that sort of thing. But yeah, I don't really know what his operational ethos is.
I interviewed Roland Emmerich like once before, so White House Down, I only had a couple of minutes. If I had like a real sit down interview with Roland Emmerich, you gave me like half an hour. Mm. That's what I want to talk about. This is the through line of your career. Mm. Not every film hits it, but most of them do. Conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
Which ones do you actually believe? Which ones are you just entertaining for fun?
Or are these just like what if scenarios?
Is it just a what if scenario and you think it's fun and it's a formula? And if it's a formula, great. Let's talk about that formula and how that works. And whether or not that has maybe any impact on like the idea that we should take conspiracy theories seriously. Do you actually believe any of this stuff? I'd be very curious if he did. Maybe he leaves some and not others. I don't know. That's what fascinates me. And that's kind of what I want to know most about his career. But anyway, I digress. Let's move on and let's talk about a very different film.
Well, there's nothing like nothing else like Moonfall this week, is there?
No. And by the way, we apologize. Neither of us saw Jackass. I know a lot of people are seeing Jackass.
Yeah.
Neither of us got a chance to see Jackass.
It's been getting weirdly like glowing reviews, the newest Jackass film.
Feel
it's
like...
the fourth, third, fourth...
I think it's the fourth film. It's
I haven't seen any of the Jackass films.
I've only seen the TV show.
It's been, and yeah, I never saw the TV show. Either,
I saw the TV
so
show.
So this is something out of my wheelhouse.
I don't have the nostalgic connection to it because I was never that into it in the first place. I know some a lot of people who really love the movies. That's fine. I never really got into them. At some point, I guess I'll watch them, but it will not be this day. I don't know if my opinion is particularly useful. Based on my lack of knowledge, considering it seems as though most people are connecting to this as the gangs back together again, which won't have any impact on me because I don't have that connection to them.
I did read a really wonderful essay in the LA Weekly a long time ago. I think it might have been Karina Longworth. About sort of how important the Jackass films are in terms of purity of cinema. And the idea of ecstatic truth, the thing that you cannot fake on camera.
Yeah.
This idea of these guys, you know, let's climb to the top of a tree and then chainsaw it down. And what are you going to do when the tree falls? Well, I'm going to get hurt. Okay, let's watch that.
Yeah, there's a certain cinematic brilliance to the idea.
Yeah, like the fear and the pain is not a stunt. It's not a Hollywood anything. It's just somebody who's actually afraid and they're doing it for your entertainment. And there's a weird integrity to that. But that's all I can really comment on.
Yeah.
Just sort of Jackass as a concept.
Yeah.
I can comment on films I've seen, and one film I've seen, I'm guessing you're going to the Joachim Trier movie.
Yeah, there's a new film by Joachim Trier called The Worst Person in the World, which I'm going to say it now.
Or it might be Joachim.
It might be Joachim.
Because he's a Norwegian director, I believe.
No, I don't think he is.
Yeah, he was born in... He did Oslo, August 31, okay. Louder Than Bombs. He was born in Copenhagen, so he's Danish.
Okay, so that was why I thought. Okay, there you go. I'm not crazy. Right. In any case, he's a celebrated filmmaker, and his latest film is called The Worst Person in the World, and it is a title that is basically setting you up a little bit, I think. Well, because it's suggesting that you're going to judge this person a lot more harshly than you actually are.
I think what's going on here is we see the main character, her name is Yuli, and she's played by an actress named Renate Reinsve.
Mm-hmm. We apologize for pronouncing that wrong.
And it's essentially a film about how, as a young person, it covers several years of her life from, like,
early like 20s to early 30s.
College years, yeah, to about the age of 30. And essentially how throughout your 20s, you make a series of really horrible decisions.
Yeah, these aren't like horrible, like people are going to die, I'm ruining everything, I'm a horrible human being.
Robbing a bank or DOT.
It's just your decisions are based off of you not knowing what you want, not knowing what the consequences will be of the decisions that you make. And as you try to figure out your path in the world, what you want to do career-wise, what kind of person you were looking for in a relationship, you cannot help but hurt some people along the way.
Yeah. And
it's just impossible. Like that's your impact. At some point, you're going to be the bad guy.
The title is playing off of the kind of guilt we feel after the fact that we made these bad decisions. We know that we hurt somebody.
Mm-hmm. I didn't say bad. I think just tough decisions. You know, just like
or deliberately mean because you're in that kind of a mood in that part of your life. Mm-hmm. And I think the title refers to sort of retroactive guilt. Also that. And I'm not going to reveal what it is, but something happens to the main character late in the film, which in maybe an American film or a different kind of film would be considered a horrendous tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually very positive for her. So that's another way.
It's actually very eye-opening.
Yeah, it kind of plays into the title as well.
Great.
I really like this movie.
This movie's amazing.
Because of how frank it is about the main character.
Mm-hmm.
And it never turns her into a hero.
No.
Never turns her into a villain either.
But we never lose our sympathy for her.
We understand why she makes the decisions she does.
Mm-hmm.
We understand that they're bad decisions. And if you've lived through your 20s, you recognize a lot of that stuff.
I hesitate to call them bad decisions. It's just, this is what she decided to do. And the movie is understanding enough about the complexities of life and the impact of what we do on other people that there are good effects and bad effects that come of this. They're just decisions that there's no perfect decision. There's nothing. Some of them are more selfish than others, but sometimes the more selfish decisions are better in the long run for everybody.
While she's going along, she's hurting people kind of deliberately. There's an entire portion of this movie where she's dating a comic book artist who she already left her current boyfriend to date this comic book artist,
and they've moved in together. They're pretty good together.
And she goes to a party and starts flirting with this other guy, and they clearly want to sleep together. There's this really long sequence in the movie where they are clearly very attracted to each other, might be falling in love, but more than anything, it's just really lustful.
It's this great bit. They're trying
to figure out what can we do physically
that isn't
technically cheating. Yeah. And they're doing things like taking drags on cigarettes and blowing the smoke into each other's mouths. That's really intimate. Is that cheating? And they say, no, that doesn't count.
They're spending the whole night together just seeing how intimate they can be without officially crossing a line. Right. She can't go back to her boyfriend.
What if we pee in front of each other. That's a really intimate thing as well, but that's also not cheating.
It's also not erotic, really. They're just doing it. Like, it's, there's something about that whole there's wonderful bits in this movie that on their own could be, like, Academy Award winning short films.
Uh-huh.
But they all connect really, really beautifully. That whole section is just incredibly sexy.
Mm-hmm.
That whole bit, it's a thing that you encounter at some point in your life, if you're lucky, where you meet someone and very quickly you're just really into each other. And you have a story together.
Yeah.
Really, for maybe it's a short period of time, maybe not. There's this incredible sequence where after she goes back to her boyfriend and she's not really happy, but also they're not unhappy either. It's just a relationship and she's realizing that I'm in my 20s and this isn't really what I want right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to make her the bad guy if she ever decides to break up with him. There's a fantasy sequence in that bit, which is very magical realism. Where all of a sudden what she wants becomes very clear to her in a very visually innovative way. That whole bit is beautifully brilliant. That whole bit, that made my heart soar. That whole bit's amazing.
I saw that as an incredibly cynical sequence.
Oh, really? I saw that as really beautiful.
Where she was deliberately abandoning something to go live in this sort of like idealized film fantasy version of something that was actually ultimately very harmful.
No, see, for me, that's great, because I think that's a perfectly valid take on it. But for me, that sequence was after years, months or years, it's hard to say exactly how long it's been taking place, but after a long period of time of being in this relationship and just being just sort of, at like 60%. You know, like, not bad enough you need to break up, but this isn't making me happy. And, like, denying the fact that she had this wonderful experience with another guy, and denying that this has, like, been sort of living in the back of her head, that this experience is possible, ergo my current relationship might not be the one for me. It's a moment of pure clarity. Mm. And if she decides to act on it, it will hurt the other guy.
Yeah.
And who knows? Maybe in the long run, it might not be the best thing for everybody. But it's her realizing this is what I want. And on that level, what's that line? Is there in truth no beauty?
Yeah.
Truth is beauty, beauty is truth. Yeah. At the very least, the truth of it is beautiful. All right. The self-awareness is beautiful. That, for me, is what I call it. Right.
I think this film doesn't really ever want to side with her in that kind of way. Yeah. I feel it doesn't side with her.
I don't
think
it's siding with her either. I think it's just understanding her.
It understands her, but I don't think it's really trying to necessarily pass any kind of judgment on this main character. And that's why I like this movie so much.
Agreed.
Is that it shows somebody who is having a lot of formative growth experiences.
Yeah.
And there's something this is as somebody who's, I'm in my early 40s,
yeah.
Sort of the perspective you get on your 20s after the fact. I think it was Alonso Duralde who said, you spend your 20s embarrassed of your teen years, and you spend your 30s being embarrassed of your 20s.
And then you spend your 40s being embarrassed of your 30s. That is one of the best pieces of advice I've heard in my whole life, because boy, is that true.
I was even reminded
so
of
embarrassed. So much I've ever done in my life.
Robert Eggers, if you ever read Robert Eggers' book, Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius, which is autobiography.
Okay. I haven't read that one.
I'm going to bring it up later because one of the movies I'm talking about also bears some resemblance. But in the introduction, he says, I apologize for writing this book because it's about people in their 20s.
Robert Eggers directed
The Witch.
Oh, excuse
me, you're right, Dave Eggers.
That was driving me nuts. I was like, Robert Eggers directed?
Apologies.
Okay, yeah.
Dave Eggers, the author who wrote Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius.
Yeah, different guys.
But in the intro, he says, I apologize for this book because I wrote it about people in their 20s, and as we all know, that those people are awful. And I read it in my 20s. So it's like, wait a minute, well, we're awful? No, we've got everything figured out, man. We're adults making decisions. Yeah, you're making shit decisions.
You're making very shitty decisions for the most part.
And that's what I like about this movie. It's about this young woman who is making a lot of really shitty decisions, mm-hmm. who are harmful to others and, you know, based on really rash reasoning. But at the same time, it's very real.
Yeah.
And that's something that we can all kind of relate to, especially if we survive our 20s and we gain some perspective on it.
And I really do.
I don't mean to condescend to any of our listeners who are in their 20s.
No. But this is a fair point, I feel. And it's something that as I grow older, you know, I'm turning 40 in like a month. And like, I have the saying,
you spring lamb.
I have hang-ups about getting older. Mm. I had hang-ups about turning 30. I had hang-ups about all this kind of stuff. I'm finally, I'm going to leave my mid-30s, finally. Mm. Going to be in my early 40s until about 44. I have hang-ups about getting older, but what I like about getting older, and that sometimes it leads to a lot of embarrassment and sort of humility and shame over the kind of things that I've done or believed or mistakes that I've made in the past, but I like being wiser.
Mm.
That's a great feeling, is to have at least some sense that I know more than I used to, and then I know that in 10 years I'll be embarrassed by how little I know now.
Yeah,
at least I know now.
Socratic wisdom, as they say.
Yeah, this is about
somebody who...
Yeah.
Is still acquiring wisdom. And I think by the end, when there's a moment, and again, I don't want to say what happens, but there's a moment where she faces mortality very directly, that death becomes a part of her experience. I'm not going to say how.
Yeah.
But that gives her some actual humility.
Yeah.
And it's in those moments where she realizes she's actually having growth experiences rather than kind of deliberately or recklessly making bad decisions and chalking that up to growth experience.
And this is why I honestly think this is one of the best movies I've ever seen about being in your 20s.
Okay, yeah, that's fair.
I do, and not every movie in which people are in their 20s is about being in your 20s. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about movies that are about the experience of being a young adult on your own for the first time, experiencing the world. This film understands what it's like to be in that moment, but it is coming from a place of the story is clearly being told by a filmmaker who's older than that and who understands the greater context of this without losing the insight of what it's actually like to be there in the moment. Wisdom, I was kind of leading up to this earlier, wisdom, by definition, always comes too late.
It has to.
It has to.
It comes after the fact. That's what it means.
Otherwise, it's just advice. You know, people tell you things like, you know, let's say the early bird gets the worm, and then you say to yourself, okay, thank you. And then you actually experience something in your life where you put something off, and then as a result, there's an actual consequence. You'll never get that because you didn't strike while the iron is hot. Now you've learned through personal experience the importance of taking action when action is needed. This is just hypothetical, just throwing it out there. Now you know that through personal experience. That is wisdom. Mm. Wisdom is earned. This is a movie about gradually acquiring wisdom and all of the mistakes you have to make along the way in order to get there. And she's still not, you know, a sage-like at the end of this. Mm. She's just not in her 20s anymore. And she's starting to get her shit together. Yeah, that's where the movie basically leaves us, is starting to get her shit together. I would be thrilled if this turned into Trier's, like, Apu trilogy or Antoine Doinel series. I would be thrilled in 10 years to visit this person in their 30s. And in 10 years, visit this person in their 40s.
And Joachim Trier's perspective on... Because I just looked him up. He's in his late 40s.
Yeah, he's not that old. So he's got time.
Yeah, he can grow with the character and give, you know, a little bit more perspective.
And Reinsve, who stars in this, and this is someone who is, as my understanding, she was on the verge of quitting acting.
Oh, wow.
She'd been she had one small role in one of Trier's films, and he just came to her and said, I'm thinking about making a movie and kind of building it around you, and they started talking about her experiences and kind of built it around together. It sounds like a bit of a collaborative storytelling thing. I would love to see them work together.
That'd be great.
She is astoundingly good in this movie. This is the star-making turn if ever I've seen one. Mm-hmm. Hollywood's going to come knocking. I hope they don't
put her in a superhero costume.
I hope they don't do what they did to Nomi Rapace, which is bring her over, try to do a couple of big, stupid blockbusters with them, and then decide, we don't know what to do with them, and then just kick them aside.
Sherlock Holmes, Alien, no? Okay, no. Bye.
Yeah, it never really worked out. And she's a brilliant actor. I love Nomi Rapace. Yeah. Hollywood didn't do right by her. I hope that she attracts the attention of great storytellers who have some sense of what to do with how talented she is.
Or she can just continue, you know, she's Norwegian, just stay in Norway.
Well, I said great storytellers, I didn't say from where.
Yeah, okay.
I just hoped, I would like to see her in more things. If she wants to quit and continue, I think she's going to be like a carpenter or something. If she wants to quit and do whatever she wants to do, knock yourself out, be happy. Yeah, but I would love to see you in more things because you're super talented.
I would put this in like a triple feature with Francis Ha and Metropolitan.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
Other films about sort of smart people who are just have no wisdom whatsoever.
Yeah.
They're smarter than they are wise.
That's a good one.
But it doesn't have the kind of, it's a little, slightly more sardonic than those movies. It doesn't have the sense of whimsy as something like Francis Ha.
Yeah.
But I think it is about this notion of coming to the end of your young adulthood.
Yeah.
The sort of second adolescence that, which is pretty sharply experienced by this generation in particular, but by most people in their 20s throughout history.
I think it's weird to think about, like, when Americans started treating your 20s as yet another era in which to come of age.
Yeah.
That's when we started getting, like, Judd Apatow movies. And we started getting, like, well, the 40-Year-Old Virgin is about 40-year-olds, but, like, we started getting stuff, like, Knocked Up.
Yeah, these people in their, like, mid to late 20s, early 30s, who are only now starting to become adults. Yeah.
When Trier does it, we get, like, the new, the 400 Blows. Like, that's a very different, it's a much different, this is an exceptional motion picture. Please see this movie. It's so damn good. I think you're really going to get a lot out of it. It's a beautiful film. It's funny. It's sexy. It's very sad, but in a way that's not like exploitatively sad. Like, we're going to make you cry, damn it. It's like, no, it earns it. It's just life. It's really beautiful.
Yeah.
But it's really excellent. I'm so glad I saw it. Why don't you tell me about something else?
Okay.
What do you want to talk about?
Did you want to hear about Slapface, or do you want to hear about polystyrene?
I want to hear about whatever you want to talk about next.
Okay. Let's talk about polystyrene.
Okay.
Polystyrene is one seminal punk rocker.
Okay.
She was front woman for the X-ray, for X-ray Specs, band X-ray, spelled with an X, X-ray Specs. Mm-hmm. And she was an unconventional figure even in the punk circuit. She had a very interesting look.
Mm.
She's black, which was unusual for somebody who led a punk band. There weren't a lot of black punk bands out there.
Mm-hmm. Certainly not well known in the mainstream. Yeah.
And she always was very aggressively determined to sort of create her own style. So she actually dressed out of thrift shops. She looked like an extra in a John Waters film. She was on these bright pink jumpers and giant shoes. And she and the X-ray Specs, you probably heard some of their songs in movies. Oh, Bondage Up Yours is one of their bigger hits. The Day the World Turned Dayglow is another one of their big hits. The Day the World Turned Dayglow played over the credits to Fast Color, that superhero.
Oh,
They talk a lot about X-ray Specs in the movie Fast Color. I love X-ray Specs. I have a retrospective album of theirs. I've looked into polystyrene.
They're one of those bands who I'm not entirely sure if I know them or not. I don't follow music as closely as you do. If you played some of their music, I go, oh yeah.
I'm not,
I don't know them off the top of my head.
I'm no rock historian. I'm not a deep cut punk guy, but I do like punk.
I concede that you know more about especially that era pop music or popular music than I do.
They say that when you turn 33, that's the average age you stop paying attention to new music.
Yeah.
They've done polls on this sort of thing. There's figures on it. And when I was in sort of my mid 30s, I started looking back and getting into sort of a lot of more interesting punk acts. And that's when I discovered X-ray Specs.
Funny for me, it's kind of the opposite. I started getting kind of fascinated. I remember the first time I was listening to the radio, I'm for the last five songs, I have no idea what the fuck is going on.
Mm.
And I got really interested, ooh, I get to explore. It's like being Indiana Jones, but the archaeology is now. I think it's kind of interesting, actually, what's going on in music right now.
I did go through a bad breakup in my 20s, and I started listening to, simplest, dumbest bubblegum pop. You play it on Radio Disney, that kind of. So all of a sudden I know about Bewitched and the A-Teens and Element, spelled L-M-N-T.
Who left the toys out? Ooh.
Oh my god, it was so fucking embarrassing. The Disney rendition of Mambo Number 5.
No, I didn't even heard that. What do they do?
List all Angela, the people we've had sex with. Yeah. Cassandra and Rita. It's Mickey and Minnie and Daisy and Donald.
Adorably.
It's pretty
bad.
Sick.
So not cool.
Anyway, but back to X-ray Specs. X-ray Specs, wonderfully hard-edged punk act, and polystyrene was sort of it was her brainchild. She really liked sort of pushing the whole band, and. This movie about polystyrene is a biography that is directed and narrated by Celeste Bell, her daughter.
Oh.
And she doesn't have a very rosy view of her mother because polystyrene, was, a punk rocker, weirdly distant, kind of a workaholic, and also suffering from some pretty horrible mental illnesses.
Oh, dear.
And in fact, polystyrene was at one point in her life committed to an institution. Polystyrene believed in a very Holden Caulfield sort of way to look out for phonies and phoniness. In fact, that's where she got her name, polystyrene, something kind of plastic. She's kind of satirizing this idea of plastic people. And she's looking around in England and seeing sort of consumer culture taking over in the early 1980s and sort of feeling very critical of it, that people are getting a little too artificial. And so she wrote a lot of songs along those lines. X-ray Specs had a very interesting sound in that her voice, she could just trumpet through walls. She had this really wonderful voice. And they also added really wild saxophones and these kind of jazz notes to punk rock. So it had a really interesting sound to it. And as she sort of started to take over the punk scene and actually gain fame, she became a lot more uncomfortable with these things that she was really wary of, this sort of phoniness, and sort of started rejecting the world and in bigger and bigger ways as she became more famous. And there's a lot of interviews with her throughout this film about how she's trying to just say, no, I think everything's kind of phony. And there, her daughter tells a story about how she was at a party with Johnny Rotten of the Sex Pistols.
Mm.
And how a big part of the punk ethos is just fuck everything, right? It's tear everything down, attack all systems, just, you know, it's all nihilism and anarchy. And so a lot of the punk scene, a lot of the people who were in it were just fuck everybody kind of people.
Yeah.
And they were just sort of generally pretty rude and very and antagonistic. And evidently, the story of polystyrene is at a party with Johnny Rotten. Everybody's just being a complete dick to everybody else. And it was at this party where she excused herself. She went into the bathroom and she came out with a shaved head. She's like, this was sort of like her big sort of defiant moment.
Yeah.
Just like, she couldn't really stand it anymore. And shortly thereafter, she was committed into an institution. And told through her daughter's eyes, she saw that she was really devoted to the music, but she didn't like the scene. But both of those things kind of went hand in hand. And that kind of made her crack after a while. And it wasn't until many, many years later, after her daughter was grown, was an adolescent, and she was doing like sort of tours again. She was back on stage and like sort of had reunited X-ray specs, and she got to sing with her daughter, that her daughter kind of started having pleasant memories of her mom. And polystyrene ended up dying of breast cancer at a pretty young age. Fascinating human being, polystyrene. Fascinating band, X-ray Specs. One of the more important punk bands to come out of England. And, you know, a good expose as to how the punk ethos is a destructive one.
Yeah, I was about to say.
By design, it is. Like, there was a biographical film, a fictional film, about Darby Crash from the Germs.
Oh.
It's called What We Do Is Secret. And,
I remember that kind of,
And... Oh, who played Darby Crash? And that was somebody notable played Darby Crash. But that was about how there was also the film Control, the Anton Corbijn movie, which is about Ian Curtis from Joy Division. And those films are about how you know, punk is ultimately very self-destructive. Sid and Nancy is another example.
Yeah, I can see why you forgot who it was. It was Shane West who played Darby Crash.
He's some guy, isn't he?
He was briefly a thing.
He was going to be a thing, and he played Darby Crash.
Yeah, never quite kicked off for him. Like, it was like, did some, like, I think it was in, like, a hit TV show, and the movie career never quite kicked.
I admire the passion and the outrage and the hate that goes into making punk rock. And, of course, if you're doing it right, you die. That's why there aren't a lot of old punk rockers. Watch the film SLC Punk at some point. Talks a lot about that.
Yeah. Remember when we used to have, I don't remember what station it was. We used to have a lunchtime rock show on LA radio called Jonesy's Jukebox.
Oh, yeah.
It was one of the guys from the Sex Pistols, wasn't it?
Who was Jonesy?
Jonesy was,
I know Jonesy's Jukebox.
Yeah, but he was an aging punk rocker, and it was just kind of like, all that Jonesy's Jukebox. Here's where we are. It was on KLOS. Jonesy's Jukebox.
You're just looking it up.
I don't know what. I could positive, but that'd be boring. No, Steve Jones. He was the guitarist from the Sex Pistols. There you go. But anyway, he actually survived.
Yeah.
Jonesy's Jukebox, he was adding, even though he had great taste in music, it was a wonderful show. I listened to it all the time. He was so chill. There's something about it. It's like, I did all my living in the 80s, and now I'm just going to talk real slow and quiet. I'm just here in my chair. You want to listen to some music? You want to listen to some tunes? Like, he was super chill. Yeah. He lived all of his living done in the 80s, and now he's just got no energy left. And there's something really kind of calming and reassuring about that. It's like when you watch Ozzy Osbourne on The Osbournes, it's just like, You kind of burned out, didn't you?
Figured it out. Yeah. He's
done.
There's
a lot left. Yeah.
Hey, you want a drink? Look, I drained London once. I don't want to drink anymore.
Pepsi, thank you.
I think this, but you know, the devotion and the actual, you know, punk ethos, the hatred of systems, and the devotion to tearing them all down in this anarchistic, violent, angry sort of way is something that's very relatable, and I think it's I don't want to call it admirable, but it's a relatable thing that we can all understand.
Yeah.
The sort of, you know, civilization, its discontents. This is the music of the discontents.
Right.
And polystyrene wanted to point that out in an artistic way, but because she was part of the punk scene, she was kind of being dragged down a little bit by a lot of the ethos around her, even though she was a lot more content to retire to a normal life when she wasn't on stage.
Yeah.
And her daughter talks about how, you know, they went shopping a lot and people would sort of come up to her and say, oh, you're so wonderful. And she was a little bit uncomfortable with that.
Yeah, that's my art. Here's my life.
And at one point during that same party, she talked about, I want to go back to who I don't want to be polystyrene anymore. I want to go back to being who I was. Like she actually wanted to live a bit of a normal life and had a lot of trouble with that.
Yeah.
And that sort of reflected badly on her role as a mother. So her daughter is talking about how she didn't do so good a job at that, you know, very frankly about it.
Wow.
This one's on demand. It's in certain theaters in LA, but yeah, you can just rent this on demand for a couple bucks.
Okay.
If you're interested in punk rock and you don't know X-Ray Specs, I highly encourage you.
Oh, yeah.
Just because it's a wonderful period of music. It's a period of music I'm really keen on. I just love girl punk bands as well. I was trying to think, like, my gateway was like playing Guitar Hero. Like, they had newer pop punk sort of stuff. Okay. It's like, oh, this is fun. Where did this stuff come from? And I started sort of going into the past and finding a lot more punk bands that I was a lot more. So now I have like Germs Records and Dead Kennedys and
Guitar Hero.
X-Ray Specs as well.
And you did good.
X-Ray Specs and X. That sort of punk, post-punk, and new wave bubble is all really fascinating because there was a lot of experimentation, a lot of rage and philosophy just sort of being bandied about. Big fan of Devo as well, which sort of spans everything. X-Ray Specs is just really, really fascinating, and it's interesting to get such an intimate, sort of frank, warts and all portrait of polystyrene.
Cool. All right, I have no good segue. Between that and my next film. My next film is a low-budget horror movie, currently I think in some theaters and on VOD.
Well, I have one of those too, so we can at least link those two together.
Yay! It's called Alone With You, and it is a low-budget horror thriller about someone trapped in their apartment.
I wonder where they got the idea for that.
Well, it's my understanding that it was made during the COVID era. But it's also, you know, we look at, like, COVID forced a lot of people to get creative. You know, we saw that great horror movie Host, which was basically about a haunted Zoom call, which...
Very clever movie.
It works! I like that one. It's a great, straightforward horror movie that acknowledges the realities of the time. While telling a universally, just at any era, this will be solid, scary story. That movie is quite exceptional. The idea of, we are on a budget, people. What can we do? How can we make a movie with very limited resources? That dates back as far back as filmmaking goes. Hmm. Trying to do what you can with what you have. And a lot of low-budget horror movies have been produced along these methods. They're not always this confined, but some of them are. Paranormal Activity was basically, let's get some cameras in a house. Something like Repulsion. You know, that's basically just someone losing their mind in a house. Hmm. It's considered one of the scariest movies ever made. The director is a piece of shit, but the movie is well-respected. Something like Carnival of Souls, very cheap. Night of the Living Dead, very fucking cheap. Cheapness is not a problem unless you feel like it's holding the movie back. Unless you're like, there's something wrong that money could have solved.
Yeah, I feel... I feel like, Don Coscarelli, like, he makes big horror movie ideas, but never has the budget to match them.
Yeah.
Whereas something like Paranormal Activity, that works really well.
You don't need any more money. Paranormal Activity didn't need any more money than it had. It would not have been...
That's a pretty darn good movie.
You throw another $500,000 to that movie, the movie doesn't get better. Hmm. The movie is just might have been different, might have had more production design or more visual effects, but the movie would not have been better, it just would have been more expensive. But yeah, one could look at something like John dies at the end and he realized that, like, yeah, if Don had a little bit more money, that might have been a little stronger of a film.
Like another $10 million. Yeah, he could have done a lot with that movie.
It's clearly a bit more ambitious than it actually can pull out. Like, still a great movie, though.
Multi-dimensional monster movie.
Yeah, still a great movie, but, like, if he'd been able to imagine, to visualize what he was really imagining, good McGuire. Along With You was written and directed by Emily Bennett and Justin Brooks. Emily Bennett also stars in the film as a woman who is in a relationship with a photographer. She is at home alone. Her photographer girlfriend is out on a business trip and she's waiting for her to come home so they can celebrate, be together, be romantic. And we're basically, aside from a couple of flashbacks to them like at a beach, we're pretty much alone in the apartment with Emily Bennett. It's night. One of her friends is FaceTiming her from a bar, saying, "Come on out and hang out with me. I never see you anymore. You're in this really codependent relationship, and it's like really dragging you down. And I regret ever introducing the two of you. Would you please come out and like actually live a life with me?" And she says, "No, my girlfriend's coming. I gotta just hang out here." And she just starts wandering around an apartment with a somewhat confusing space. Which I'm sure is at least partly by design, so that it feels a little labyrinthine, even though it's clearly an apartment.
Which can also be, bad sense of spatial continuity.
It can. Here they're clearly trying to make it like a little bit scary. Like you're never like entirely sure.
All right.
Just how giant it, just how trapped she really is. It's not. I think that part works fine. There's a couple of little distinct elements in the apartment that are kind of creepy. Her girlfriend has a series of mannequins. Like in her studio that are covered up in tarps.
That's not terrifying.
That's not
at
creepy
all.
At all. There is a vent, an air vent, through which she can kind of hear what's going on next door. And what's going on next door seems a little upsetting. And we're not sure how to deal with that. But the real kicker is when her mom calls her. Her mom is played by Barbara Crampton. Always a pleasure to see Barbara Crampton.
Yay!
Yeah, just an absolute horror icon, Barbara Crampton. Never gets a bad performance.
You still haven't seen Jacob's Wife,
have you? I still haven't seen Jacob's Wife, but I know of her. I've seen many other films she's been in. She's one of my favorites. Her mom calls and says, "Hey, something very upsetting. Your grandmother died. I was wondering if she gave you a necklace that I'd like to bury with her. I was wondering if you could find it for me."
And
this leads to a series of conversations where just conversation devolves with her mom. And they start yelling at each other. And it's while she's yelling at her mom in the middle of the night that she realizes that she can see outside her mom's window and it's the middle of the day and they live in the same time zone.
Oh, that's a little odd.
That's a very creepy setup. That's a nice...
That's like nice little Blair Witch moment.
Yeah, and it's like if you're kind of paying attention, you can pick up on it before her. And I'm like, okay, all right, it's creepy. This is super creepy. And then she realizes, she tries to like look outside and she realizes that there's like some kind of tarp covering all of her windows and she can't like reach it.
All right.
So like she doesn't know what the hell's going on and
so reality her front is door sort of rent asunder.
Her reality is starting to rent asunder and also her front door is locked and she can't open it and she starts trying to call people to try to help her open the door and no one does. She calls her landlord, nothing doing. She calls her friend at the bar, "Could you come in and help me open this door?" Friend at the bar isn't being very helpful. She calls 911. 911 doesn't seem to think it's much of an emergency, but they say, "Fine, we'll send someone." Hours go by. She calls 911 again. 911, not only do they say the same thing, but after she has the conversation with them, the exact same thing that they said, they start saying it again, and it seems like it's a recording.
Wow.
Like, there's a lot of really cool,
creepy
moments in
this. I like that. Okay.
There's a lot of cool, creepy setups and moments in here where, like, conceptually, I'm like, ooh, okay. Hmm. This would give me goosebumps. This is kind of eerie. The problem with the movie is that it just ultimately doesn't really amount to much. Like, everything you think you... Okay, here's what I assume is probably happening right now. And your brain's probably going to go to one of, like, three or four different places. Maybe she's already dead. Or, she's lost her mind and she doesn't realize that she killed her girlfriend. Or, lost her mind and didn't realize that her girlfriend tried to kill her. Or maybe they already broke up and it's been years and now she doesn't know. Maybe she's an old lady now. There's a handful of things this could be. And it just turns out to be one of them.
Oh.
there's no real big surprise coming for you here, which is a shame because all it is setup.
Yeah.
It's all set up, and it just, we never get that, like, sublime moment. Like, in Carnival of Souls, it's a setup, and nowadays we can kind of see where it's going, because Carnival of Souls has been ripped off so much. But the reveal for the protagonist is kind of halfway horrifying and halfway an epiphany. Like, it's important to them. Yeah. So it functions dramatically, even if you already know the twist. Here, it just feels like we had some neat ideas for, like, horror gimmicks we could do inside an apartment, and Emily Bennett is definitely doing her very best to give an emotionally wrought performance. She's not a bad actor at all. She's doing fine. It just ultimately feels like, oh, yeah. Okay, cool. Well, thanks. Like, that's kind of, like, all I can do at the end of this movie is go, that's a nice low-budget horror movie you made, but I never really felt like the reason... I never really felt like I got anything out of it other than you proved that you can make a decent low-budget horror movie. Like, yeah, it never really feels like there's a story that had to be told, like there's something important that's coming across, something cathartic coming out of it.
If it just is good at scaring you, that's the function of a horror movie.
But the problem is that because I kind of, like, was ahead of what the supernatural things were a mystery for...
Hmm.
Wasn't that scary? That's one of the problems. It's like it's all kind of mysterious, but if you kind of see where it's going from here, and it just goes there,
okay.
It's only so scary, you know.
Mm.
It's like I don't know if I invited you to dinner, and I invited you to dinner at sunset, and then you opened the door, and I was wearing a cape and a Dracula medal. And I was like, come on in, would you care for some red wine? And you were like, okay. And then at the end of the night, after many, many, like, twists and turns, I revealed that I was a vampire. It might still be like, oh, no, that's not good. But he would also not be shocked.
Yes.
And who'd kind of just feel like there was a lot of buildup when we could have gotten... This, here's what I feel. This is a great horror short.
Mm-hmm.
Probably not enough material for a feature. Like, if this was like a half... This was a half-hour radio drama.
All right.
This would be scary as hell. But I just feel like the material is just...
on adapting it.
I just feel like the material is a little too thin to carry a full-length feature without me eventually just getting ahead of it and waiting for the movie to wrap up.
Yeah.
And your mileage might vary on that. You might not necessarily jump to the conclusion that I did and then turned out to be right. This is not a bragging rights thing. That this is not a big deal. It just ultimately just seemed like it just kind of followed the path that it was on and then concluded.
Nah.
But it's reasonably well made. The acting is pretty good. There's a couple of really creepy ideas in here. I just don't feel like they add up to a lot. But I've definitely seen worse movies.
All right.
Yeah. So this is a definition of a mixed bag.
Yeah.
Just definition of a mixed bag. Good setup, doesn't really amount to much.
All right.
What about you? What about the horror film you saw?
Well, I saw a low budget horror movie called Slapface. This is one that debuted on Shudder, and it was directed by someone named Jeremiah Kipp. I'm unfamiliar with them.
Okay.
I think it's expanded from a short film of theirs. It is about I mentioned Dave Eggers. And Dave Eggers' book, A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius, is about when he's in his 20s and his younger brother living together because they just recently lost both of their parents, rather dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about how they try to sort of figure out what life is together, he and his much younger brother. This is a similar setup. It's about a young boy, he's maybe 13, and his older brother, who's like in his early 20s. And they, their dad has long since been out of the picture, and they both just lost their mom. And they're trying to figure out just what they do. The younger of them, the main character, he's played by an actor named August Maturo, has a couple friends he hangs out with, but they're not really friends, they're actually bullies. And they're constantly making fun of him and chasing him, and like he still goes back to hang out with them, because one of them actually has a crush on him. And they're trying to sort of have a little bit of a secret relationship. Meanwhile, the older brother is just sort of going to bars and getting drunk and trying to pick up on the ladies. One afternoon, while hanging out with the bullies, the younger of the two of them, the young boy, is dared to go into, wouldn't you know it, the local haunted sanitarium.
Oh, no!
Because every town has one of those.
We do.
Do we?
Yeah. They shoot a lot of movies there. It's over in Hawthorne, isn't it?
Oh, is there an abandoned hospital? I know there's one, like, it's not in L.A. proper. I think there's one, like, a little bit up the coast. It's like an abandoned building that they shot a lot of
stuff. I'm going to look it up because they filmed a million movies there. Right. Hang on a second.
But he goes in there, and wouldn't you know it, there is a witch living in there. And it's not a human witch. This is like a monster. It's like a 7-foot-tall thing with long, spindly fingers and clearly has magical powers and doesn't speak. It just sort of growls and does harm. And he's terrified, but this thing immediately sort of attaches itself to him and is now suddenly concerned for his well-being. And whenever somebody goes to hurt this kid, which, because of his circumstances and just sort of the sad circumstances he's living in, is often this creature appears and does harm to whoever's harming him.
Mm.
The creature also goes to his house and encourages him to, like, trash things. There's a gun in the house.
Okay.
I'm going to leave that there.
That might be important later.
Yeah, there's like a literal Chekhov's gun where...
Mr. Chekhov, you left your gun here.
The characters aren't named Chekhov, so... But there's a gun introduced in the first act that comes into play later on. And it's about how this young boy, kind of unwittingly and just through his very suffering, is causing this creature to wreak havoc on the people in his life and the lives of the people he's encountering.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people get hurt. Mm. This is not a fun horror movie.
Yeah.
This film is sad and miserable. Yeah. Oh, whenever somebody gets hurt, it's sort of like in that movie Super, where a guy dresses as a superhero and has a wrench and bashes somebody in the head with a wrench. And when he does, you actually see, like, the blood and hear people, like, wail in pain.
Yeah.
It's similar to that. When somebody gets harmed by a monster, they scream and they bleed. And when somebody finds them, they wail in complete agony. The main character is constantly in tears because he's afraid and hurt and grieving and, you know, just feeling, going through this really awful phase in their life. This isn't a cathartic kind of wailing. It's just sadness after sadness after sadness.
Jesus.
It's really kind of tough to take after a while. And you begin to sort of look for what sort of the metaphor of what this monster is. And of course it's grieving. But more than that, it's this idea that we can unwittingly, and this kind of ties in with the worst person in the world, we can unwittingly, just by making the decisions we make, cause ripples of untold harm in the circles of of the people who live around us. The older brother is a complete shit, and the title comes from this abusive game that the brothers play. And if anybody has a significantly older or younger sibling, maybe you can recognize sort of the ribbing or even sort of the cruel games you might have played with one another, just sort of in a good-natured joshing, but also kind of dark way. Slap face is the game they played. They would slap each other in the face.
Yeah.
Increasingly hard.
Yeah, that sounds
right. And that becomes sort of this, as the film goes on, we see that this is being turned into sort of like a parenting style and a communication style about that is just sort of mushrooming from this mean little game that brothers played together into something that is tantamount to just legit abuse.
Jesus Christ.
So yeah, this is about sadness, misery, abuse, and death, and how that leads to more sadness, misery, abuse, and death.
And it's good.
Admire its emotional rawness.
Okay.
It's not trying to shy away from things. It's not trying to make the horror fun. It's trying to make the horror horrifying. And I feel like there's a temptation in horror movies to make the monsters a little bit too easily explainable.
Mm.
And, you know, wielded as a tool in a little bit too direct a fashion.
Mm.
Like, the Babadook, we know what that thing is.
Yeah.
Psycho Gorman is a tool of that psychopathic little girl.
Right.
In this one, it's a little bit too closely tied to this kid's emotional state in order to really define super clearly what it is, at least to the main character. So he's not exactly sure what it is. And he's happy to have it there, but at the same time understands that it's causing a lot of harm and he doesn't know how to stop it.
Right.
It's like, it's the film I wanted A Monster Calls to be. If you remember that film, A Monster Calls, about a young boy who, he's in it also in sort of like this grieving cycle, because his mother is dying. She's not even dead yet, but he's trying to sort of come to terms with the fact that his mother is mortal. And that's sort of expressed through this monster who appears outside his window, this giant tree thing, who sort of is taking him through the stages of grief. And in that movie, the kid performs all kinds of horrible, violent acts, but he's forgiven because he's going through grieving. I actually don't like that movie so much.
Yeah.
Made me cry, but I still don't like it. This one faces grief in, I think, a little bit more of a realistic way, in that you don't know how to feel a lot of the time. All you know is that you're afraid and everything's sort of awful around the world, and there's no comfort in this kid's life. His mom and his dad are gone, and all he has left is kind of an abusive older brother and bullies. Okay. There's not somebody he can sort of retreat to save him.
Yeah.
And that kind of hopelessness can be an exhilarating cinema.
Yeah.
I think there is a kind of glorious honesty that can be found in despair.
Yeah.
And there's a little bit of despair.
Well, I think horror is a great genre in which to deal with that in a cathartic way.
Yeah.
By the way, the location I was thinking of, it's called Linda Vista Hospital. It opened in 1905. By the 70s, it started like really deteriorating, and there've been like more and more like just more and more deaths there. And the place finally closed down in 1991. And
that's Reagan who did that.
Yeah, and then
91 was Clinton, I understand,
but like you know, it was part of the deteriorated to the point where it had to. And then in the years that followed, it became a very popular filming location because it was a disused hospital in the Hollywood area.
Drive out to that hospital and shoot a horror movie.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a ton of movies that have filmed there, some horror, some not. L.A. Confidential shot there. Let's see. Who was it? The Cell shot there. Insidious 2 and 3 shot there. The pilot episode of ER shot there, which I didn't know until I just looked this up just now. And I think this is probably like the creepiest thing that was ever filmed there. The music video for the Nine Inch Nails song "Closer" was shot at Linda Vista Hospital.
Nice, warm, comforting visuals in the "Closer."
It's been long rumored to be haunted. At least one or two ghost hunting shows have filmed episodes there.
Here's my view on haunting. They're all true. If somebody makes up a rumor that a place is haunted, it becomes haunted.
Pretty much. It no longer exists, or at the very least it was retrofitted. It is now a like a senior living facility of some kind. But for about 20, 25 years there, it was a major filming location in Los Angeles, and a lot of movies have filmed there, especially a lot of low-budget ones. That's Linda Vista. That's what I was thinking of.
Linda Vista.
So that was our haunted, like, asylum, although it was mostly an actual like hospital. But anyway, that is it for our new release reviews. It's time to do a bit of a review roundup. If you're new, or if you want a reminder, our reviews go thusly: we rate our films on a scale of C- to C+. The lowest rating you can get is a C-. That's below average. We don't recommend that. That's not a movie we recommend you run out and see. It could also be just terrible, but generally speaking, we don't recommend it. A C is average. Yeah, some good, some bad. Could be worse. Kind of deal. And then a C+ is above average in some way. We recommend you see it. Might be the greatest movie ever made. Anything in between, it's a C+. Whitney, where do you rank Slapface?
It's incredibly powerful. It's difficult to recommend just because it's so dour.
Yeah.
I'm going to give it a high C.
Okay.
Just because I think it really is interested in sort of feeling all of its raw emotions rather than sort of obfuscating them. But it's not not quite the revelation I think it could have been.
Next up is Alone With You, a horror film about a woman trapped in an apartment. competently produced. A couple of good scares here and there. Certainly some good ideas. But I just don't feel like it adds up to enough to truly recommend it. Like, you have to see this movie. So it's just a slightly high C. You know, just all like right. it's like if that sounds like something you would really be excited to see, you might enjoy it more than others. Everyone else, it's a rental if you're feeling up to that kind of movie right now. But it's not really like this unsung classic you're gonna have to check out. Next up, polystyrene. I am a cliche.
Polystyrene. If you're interested in punk rock and early punk in you know the London scene in the early 80s, definitely see it. It's a C plus.
Okay.
It's not going to be sort of the exhaustive history of punk because it's actually told by her daughter. It's a little bit more personal.
More
than
narrowly
that.
Focused, yeah.
So it might be upsetting if you're looking for a little bit more historical detail.
Yeah.
So I'm going to give it also a high C.
Okay. So the official review is a high C.
Yeah.
All right. But some people might really be into it more than others. Got it.
Yeah. I think...
If you're the target demo, you're going
to
like it a lot.
Your interest is going to depend on you know how you react to that kind of music. So.
All right. Fair enough. The worst person in the world.
That's a C+. Really, really dug this film. I think it's incredibly intelligent. I think it's really insightful. I think it understands something about the experience of being in your 20s and you know sort of how it can be... bad, but it's something that you kind of have to live through, and it, you know, understands sort of the ladder you climb to get to a wiser place in your life.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's beautifully performed. I think it's wonderfully conceived. I love that the filmmaker doesn't feel hamstrung by reality, and it can occasionally delve into the fantastic in order to reach at something universal and human. This is a huge C+, fantastic motion picture. Damn, it's good. Please go see it. And then lastly, Moonfall.
Tell me about Moonfall.
I'm really torn on what to give Moonfall, because there's a really good argument for a C-, a C, and a C+. C- because it is very stupid. C because it's stupid, but also glorious. Mm. And C+, because this is kind of glorious. I'm going to be kind. I'm going to give it a C+. I think this is a very entertainingly silly movie that never apologizes for being silly, and that yields some wonderfully entertaining, albeit highly absurd, sequences, moments, lines of dialogue. I had a really good time watching it, and unless your mind rejects something as ludicrous as the moon is a cover-up, which I don't blame you for, that's fine. But if you reject that, you're not going to like this movie. If you accept that that's what we're buying into today... and you just try to enjoy how relentlessly absurd and how far Roland Emmerich can take this, you're going to have an entertaining time. So I'm going to give it a low C+. And okay. That, it's not a worst person in the world C+. There is a infinite space between one the and the other.
Between the moon and...
the space between the... it's like there's infinite space between atoms in our body. Right? That's actually like a scientific thing. Like, you know, there's actually like a lot of space there. You can always divide it by half. That's as much space as is between Moonfall and The Worst Person in the World. They're both C+, but there's a lot of space between them. Anyway, that is it. That is it for Critically Acclaimed this week. Next week, we'll be back with The Death on the Nile, a new Hercule Poirot film from Kenneth Branagh with an all-star cast.
Follow-up to his version of Murder on the Orient Express.
Yeah, and other things as well.
I guess they couldn't call it Murder on the Nile. That would be a little too obvious.
Well, they're both kind of too obvious.
Death on the...
We want to have plausible deniability. Maybe it was an accident.
Yeah, one is definitely a murder. The other one is just death.
Yeah, I'm also really looking forward to reviewing...
It's a murder. There's a murder on the Nile.
I'm sure there is. I'm also really looking forward to reviewing the new Jennifer Lopez, Owen Wilson rom-com, Marry Me, which I saw the trailer for. I mean, I was just like, oh my God, yes. Yes, please. This feels like something that would have come out in the 90s, and it would have been amazing. Like, I miss this dopey era of rom-coms. Please bring it back. I hope this goes well.
And I think next week there's a film coming out called The Sky is Everywhere, which I watched already. I got to interview the director.
Cool.
So I get to transcribe that pretty soon. Okay,
look at you being all badass. Look at you.
I got
celebrity film critic and interviewer and reporter.
I'm just working again. It's nice.
I love it. I'm so happy for you, dude. Make sure you read Whitney's work. Whitney, where can they find your work?
I'm writing for Slash Film. And, oh, golly, you don't have to read it. But, I'm writing for, because I have no confidence in my work. But
You should. You're really talented.
Go to Slash Film and you can find my news stories and reviews and various chicken scratchings of mine.
Whitney is writing consistently for Slash Film. I am writing inconsistently for The Wrap. But the majority of our work you can find here on the Critically Acclaimed Network. You can also head on over to patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork for even more exclusive stuff, including our podcast All Our Yesterdays, where we review every single episode of Star Trek in order. Our podcast, Only the Best, where we review every single film ever nominated for Best Picture. We're halfway through the 1940s right now. It's a very exciting time. We have a podcast called Holy Batman. We're reviewing every single episode of the 1960s Batman. We do commentary tracks. We do hangouts with our patrons. We got a lot going on over there. Very special shout out to all of our patrons. We would not be here without you, and we never forget that for a second. Thank you for everything you do. Thank you for your contributions, and everyone else who wants to sign up. We have a lot of stuff waiting for you over there, so thank you for that. We're also on Twitter, @CriticAcclaim. I am @WilliamBibiani.
I'm @WhitneySeibel.
If you would like to email us about anything we discussed in this episode, or anything else at all you want us to talk about, any questions you want answered, anything you want to throw in our face, you disagree with our review, you think Moonfall is terrible, you think Moonfall is the greatest movie ever made, you think Moonfall is some kind of hovercraft? I don't know. Whatever you want to talk about, our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We also have a P.O. box. Whitney, what is that?
Send us an actual physical letter to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
And don't forget, Valentine's Day is coming up, and it is not too late to buy soaps from Salt Cat Soap, our Etsy store run by myself and my partner, M. Lapis Da Silva. We're on social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, @SaltCatSoap. And you can also head on over to Salt Cat Soap on Etsy. Just look for the link. We have a lot of really nice Valentine's Day gift sets that we are selling, including chocolate heart soap set. They smell delicious, smell like chocolate truffles. We also have a floral heart gift set. Smells like things like lilies and roses, and they're really, really, really nice. Hmm. And we have a lot of other wonderful soaps besides that make wonderful gifts, or if you just want to keep yourself clean, you could just buy them for that. But thank you to everybody who's already purchased our soaps. We have a lot of really, really great reviews. That means the world to us. Thank you for enjoying our stuff, and thank you for supporting the store. That is it for Critically Acclaimed this week. Thank you once again, everybody. Have a great week. We'll see you throughout the week with more and more podcasts. And never forget, everyone, yes, everyone, yes, you, everyone's a critic.
I want to go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?